from KMOX Sports.
Okay, boys, here we go.
Welcome to the Gray Bar Sports Open Line.
Those mid swings, and he hits a drive. He hits a slammer.
Gray Bar, your distributor for electrical and datacom needs.
Here we go.
Now, Matt Pauly on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
All right, man, let's get going here.
Here we go.
Let's go.
On a Tuesday evening, we welcome you in. It is time for another Gray Bar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauly, taking you for the next couple hours till 8 o'clock this evening. We've got a lot to get to here on the program. A couple guests are going to be with us. Later on this hour, we're going to talk with somebody who used to cover Mizzou Athletics, and we had on the program on occasion in Matt Stahl. He's now part of the team that covers Alabama sports for the folks at the Alabama newspaper, Alabama AL.com is the website, and what is that newspaper? Anyways, we'll talk with them, AL.com, Alabama.com. He'll talk with us. SEC football coming up later on this hour, and then also next hour, we'll head out to Kansas City. We got a few things to talk about out there. The big story of the moment is what's happening in Seattle, where the Blues are just about set to wrap up their season opener, and what at one point appeared to be a tough start to the season has turned into, in all likelihood, knock on wood. We'll get back to you on this in about 42 seconds as the game is wrapping up, and we'll tell you if and when it goes final of where it's at right now. But the Blues do have a 3-2 lead on Seattle, and there is about 42 seconds to go, and the Blues are facing off against six attackers as Seattle has pulled their goalie. So again, we'll keep you updated. What's interesting about this game, and we have not talked as much Blues on this show as I would have liked leading into the season. Just obviously everything going on with the Cardinals has impacted things, and we've talked mostly Cardinals baseball here recently. I'm not high on this Blues team. I'm just not. I want to be wrong. There are times where I'm glad that I'm right, and there's times that I'm glad that I'm wrong. And if I'm wrong on this Blues team, and I might be because I get stuff wrong fairly often, if I'm wrong on this Blues team, I will be incredibly happy to be wrong. Because I think they're better than they were last year, but I don't think they were especially good last year. I continue to question if they've got the right character in the guys who are leading the way. I look at a bunch of leaders that largely got Craig Berube fired, and I continue to have questions about this team. One game doesn't make a season, that's for sure, but I have been pleasantly surprised by what I have seen in this game, because when it got started, I think they got outshot 11-6 in the first period, and Jordan Binnington stopped everything that he saw in the first period. Second period got started, and what happens? Seattle scores two quick goals. They score two goals in the first 2 minutes and 20 seconds of the second period, and the shots were just way out of hand in terms of being in favor of Seattle. And I looked at it, and again, I'm not somebody who's going to say that that represents what the entire season's going to be, but it's also kind of what I'm in many ways expecting out of this team, where they don't score enough goals and defensively just not good enough. And then, and to their credit, and I think there's two keys for the Blues team. I think Jordan Kyrou has to score a lot of goals, and I think defensively they have to limit shots, and it is final, by the way. The Blues have opened up the season with a really good win at Seattle, 3-2. They have to stop. They have to play strong defense, and I don't know if they've got the personnel to be a strong defensive team. They need defensemen to really step up, and they need Jordan Kyrou to have a huge season. So what has happened in this game? So after Seattle got out to that 2-0 lead, scoring the two goals in the first 2 minutes and 20 seconds of the second period, and then no scoring for about 10 more minutes after that, and then all of a sudden, just a flurry of goals for the Blues, led by Jordan Kyrou, who scores a power play goal to make it 2-1. Then Philip Broberg scores. That makes it 2-2. And then Jordan Kyrou scores a second goal to make it 3-2. Those three goals are all scored in less than 3 minutes. The Blues take the 3-2 lead, and to their credit, they hold on for a 3-2 win. So whatever clicked in after they got down 2-0 in the second period, whatever clicked in during that period, it worked because the Blues were much better. Even the saves or the shots on goal, it's not great. They gave up 32 shots while getting 25 onto the Seattle goal, but they were on pace for giving up over 40 shots. So the fact that Seattle only got 32 shots on goal really show that the Blues improved defensively as the game went along. And then Jordan Kyrou did what he can do because he's got as much skill, he's got more skill than anybody on the roster in terms of the ability to put the puck in the net. And he did that in a flurry twice, and the Blues end up winning. And these are the kind of games, again, I'm not trying to make too much out of the first game of the season, but these are the kind of games that they're going to have to steal if they want to go out and find themselves in playoff contention a few months down the line. So that's a good start. That's a good start for this Blues team. You're a little worried when they're opening up the season with three straight games on the road out west. After today's game, they're going to head to San Jose to take on the Sharks on Thursday night, and then they'll play in Vegas on Friday night. They'll get the weekend off, and they'll open up the home portion of their schedule coming up on Tuesday when they welcome in the Minnesota Wild. So they get points out of this opening road trip. They get a win in their first game of the year. That's pretty good all the way around. Hopefully we'll be able to get some audio from head coach Drew Bannister and play that for you later on in the program if we're able to get that from Seattle. But that's a good win. That's a good win. So I like it when, again, just one game, but I like it when I'm wrong on things like these. I was not feeling great about this team, and then they're down 2-0, and it just kind of felt like what I felt like the season was going to feel like. And That was a really good flurry, and they win this game thanks to a flurry of goals over a three-minute period and then shoring up their defense. And defensively, if they can continue to do some version of what they did over the last, 30 or so minutes of this game, that's going to go a long way towards them coming away with a victory. All right, when we come back, I want to talk a little baseball. The baseball playoffs are continuing on. We also, I really think that payroll for the Cardinals this upcoming season is very much tied to the local media, local TV situation. And some things happened today in baseball that may or may not give an indication of what's going to happen from a TV standpoint with the Cardinals. And I know people are interested about the TV thing because they want to know where they can watch the games. Rightfully so, but the TV thing also is going to impact the amount of money that the Cardinals have to spend on payroll next year. So we're going to get into that coming up in just a moment, and the development that we saw today. It's a pretty big one across Major League Baseball. Doesn't directly impact the Cardinals, but it might have some impact. We'll explain that coming up in just a moment. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauly. Great to have you with us throughout the course of the next hour and 40 minutes. We take you till 8 o'clock tonight, taking you till 8 o'clock most nights. We'll have a full show tomorrow as well, and on Friday, then we'll have you for just about 30 minutes or so on Thursday, because we'll have Thursday night football coming up from Westwood One Sports. All right, so somewhat big news today, and this, for the moment, does not directly impact the Cardinals, but it does signal the continued changes in TV media rights when it comes to Major League Baseball teams. Because we talked about it last week when Diamond Sports Group, the group that oversees and has ownership of the Bally Sports Regional Sports Channels, when in a bankruptcy hearing last week, they essentially said that outside of the Atlanta Braves, they were not going to honor the deals, the contracts that they had with the rest of their various major league partners. So the Cardinals are in the middle of a very long deal with Diamond, with Bally, which unfortunately for the Cardinals, it was a very much a backloaded deal. So with Diamond filing for bankruptcy and basically being able to get out from underneath the liabilities of this contract that they signed, it really does hit the Cardinals in a bad way, because when they initially signed this contract, they signed it in a way that the money was going to be going up in not exponentially, but almost exponentially as it went along, and they're not going to be able to see the big time money coming in off this contract. They're going to probably have to figure out something different. Now, is there a scenario where the Cardinals are back on Bally Sports Midwest next year? Absolutely, that's a possibility. I was just reading a couple days ago that the Miami Marlins have already started to renegotiate with the Bally Florida folks, and it seems like the Marlins are likely to be back on Bally Sports next year. So Bally Sports as a whole is not completely going away, and there are opportunities for teams to renegotiate these deals. That's not going to happen in Cleveland. That's not going to happen in Milwaukee. That's not going to happen in Minnesota. And that's not going to happen in Texas. Well, Arlington. So what was announced today, Major League Baseball announced that they are going to produce and distribute the local TV games next year for the Cleveland Guardians, the Milwaukee Brewers, and the Minnesota Twins. What this actually means is it's going to look very similar to what's happening right now in San Diego and Arizona, and I believe Colorado as well. But San Diego and Arizona were the first teams where this happened. So in those markets, those game broadcasts are available on terrestrial cable like you might have, but Major League Baseball was also able to work out deals with like YouTube TV and Hulu Live TV and DirecTV Stream and Fubo and all those. I think they got deals done with just about every television carrier or television streaming service to be able to put the games on. Essentially, what happens is for the cable systems, it's just a blank channel. So it's not that they created a channel in San Diego, Arizona. They're not providing programming. It's just a blank channel. And then when it's time for those games, it goes live and they've got them there. So it'd be like if Bally Sports Midwest had nothing on it until 6:30 at night when all of a sudden the Cardinals pregame show starts. In addition to that, there is going to be a direct-to-consumer option available, and the pricing for that in Arizona and San Diego has been $20 a month just to get your team, $100 for the season, or you can get the entire MLB TV package where you get every game, including your own team, and I think it's like $200 for the year. So that's what's going to happen in Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Minnesota. Major League Baseball is going to produce those games through the facilities of MLB Network. They will then distribute them to the various cable providers, and they will also provide a direct-to-consumer streaming option. So if you're somebody who has not been able to stream games locally, you will be able to do that moving forward. So that's what's going to happen there. The Texas Rangers, they have announced that they are also going to break away from Diamond, that they are not going to be on their local Bally Sports next year, but they have not announced what they are going to do. They are still considering all broadcast options. So what does this mean for the Cardinals? I think in all likelihood, it probably indicates that the Cardinals are likely to go in the same direction that the Texas Rangers are going. I don't know this for sure, but I look at Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Minnesota, and I'm not trying to be dismissive of any of those markets, but they're mid-sized markets, and yes, St. Louis is a mid-sized market too. I'm not trying to overstate that, but the audience there is different, because the Cardinals audience is going to be, it's much more than the St. Louis metro area. There is much more of an audience for Cardinals baseball than there is for Cleveland Guardians baseball, Milwaukee Brewers baseball, and I think Minnesota Twins baseball as well. I look at what was announced by the Texas Rangers as being more likely with what's going to happen with the Cardinals, because the Rangers announced that they're breaking away from Bally, but that they are considering other local media options. The Rangers are in a bigger market. They've got more eyes that are going to be interested in their games. Even though the Cardinals aren't in a bigger market, they do have more eyes that are going to be interested in the games because of really how many markets they penetrate into. So my guess at this point is that the Cardinals will probably break away from Bally. Not a guarantee. Those games could be back on Bally next year. I don't think this is going to change anything with the broadcasters. I always get asked that question. I would expect all the broadcasters to be the same. I think the broadcast will feel the same. The graphics might look a little bit different, but that would be it. But I still think everything is on the table. Maybe they do go to kind of like what Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Minnesota are doing, where Major League Baseball produces those games. That's a possibility. Maybe they find a local TV outlet that can run the games in St. Louis while they also provide the same streaming options where anybody can go pick up the games via streaming. But no matter what happens, the revenue that the Cardinals are going to bring in, and this is the same in Cleveland, this is the same in Milwaukee, and the same in Minnesota, I would expect payroll to go down in Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Minnesota. Minnesota dropped payroll coming in this year, and they're pretty disappointed with the way things went. Maybe they are a little bit embarrassed, and they go back in the other direction. But I think in just about every Bally market, we're going to see payroll go down. Cardinals have already announced payroll going down. Quite honestly, if the Cardinals are going to kind of reboot things the way they're trying to do with player development, this is a really good year to do it, because you are probably going to drop payroll as a result of the TV situation anyways. So you'll let that kind of stabilize. You'll figure out what it's going to look like moving forward, what kind of revenue you're going to be able to create from whatever the TV situation is moving forward. But there is just so much unrest. And look, the local TV money matters. It matters a lot, especially in St. Louis. It matters a lot. But let's not also forget that the amount of money that Major League Baseball is bringing in from their national TV deals, from their deals with gambling entities. The market could very much change in St. Louis if sports gambling is legalized when it comes up on the ballot here in a month or so. There's a lot of moving parts right now, but the announcement that was made today, again, doesn't specifically involve the Cardinals, but I think you can look at this and start to see how it could impact the Cardinals moving forward. And again, we know that payroll is going to go down. We just don't know how much it's going to go down, and that might be largely impacted by what the TV situation looks like. If the Cardinals are able to work out some type of deal where a local provider comes in and wants to put those games on TV and are willing to pay big money for it, probably not as much money as Bally was going to pay, but big money, while the Cardinals still have the opportunity to provide the games as a streaming service to fans, and that's going to create revenue as well. Maybe salary doesn't go down quite as much as it could be, but if they go into a situation that's just what Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Minnesota are going into, it could be, the result could definitely be a significant reduction in salary. Now, I say all that, if all these teams are reducing salary, then where's the teams that are going to pick up salary, right? Like, for you to reduce salary, you have to shed payroll. Well, that means somebody else has to pick up payroll. If you're going to trade Sonny Gray or Wilson Contreras or Nolan Arenado, them dropping off your payroll, somebody else is going to have to pick it up. And if every Bally market in baseball is trying to shed salary, there's only going to be so many teams out there that are going to be adding payroll. So it becomes challenging. It definitely does become challenging at some point in time. All right, we are going to take a break. And when we return, we are going to talk with Matt Stahl. He covers Alabama football, Alabama athletics for the folks at AL.com. He'll be with us in just a moment or so. This is a Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on KMOX.
We are back at it, taking until 8 o'clock this evening. As always, if you want to chime in, 314-436-7900. Something rather remarkable, not just in college football, but in the world of sports, happened this past weekend when Vanderbilt of all teams, beat Alabama. And with that, we're very happy to welcome on an old friend. He used to cover the University of Missouri. Now he is covering Alabama sports for AL.com. He is Matt Stahl. You follow him on Twitter at Matt, STAHL97. Matt, appreciate you taking some time with us. Good to hear from you again.
Oh, yeah. No, thanks for having me. Good to be back on again.
What's it like in Tuscaloosa on the days following Alabama losing to Vanderbilt?
Well, you know, the sun keeps coming up, so I guess the town's going to make it. But, you know, it seems like people aren't handling it well, or I guess are handling it about as well as you would expect, given that, I mean, you can say it again, Alabama lost to Vanderbilt, which is insane. So, yeah, I mean, getting critiques from everything on, you know, defensive scheme to what Kalen DeBoer was wearing during the game.
Well, what a wild 8 days to go in and beat Georgia, and the way that Georgia game went down where they got out to such a big lead and you're going, is this real? And then Georgia gets back in it, but Alabama makes plays down the stretch. And then 7 days later, they're losing to Vanderbilt. I mean, that is from a mountain's top to a low of the valley. It's hard to think of a team experiencing more in 8 days.
No, yeah, it's been crazy. And if you back up, it's been a crazy several months in Alabama. I mean, you can go back to before the Georgia game. Their last regular season SEC game was the 4th-and-31 Iron Bowl at Auburn. So, I mean, just, yeah, crazy stuff, obviously. I mean, you're going to see here, I guess, how Kalen DeBoer can kind of handle the highs and the lows with the team. I mean, they've had both of them here real recently.
I mean, is the honeymoon for Kalen DeBoer officially over?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. No, it's one of those things where if you had told Alabama fans coming into the season you're going to be 4-1, like I think they'd have been okay with it, just because you know they assume they lose the Georgia game to what was probably going to be the number one team in the country at that point. But I mean, you know, I've said this a million times. They lost to Vanderbilt. Like, nobody, like, the coaches before Nick Saban weren't doing that. They hadn't done that since 1984. Like, he's lost to the one team that it's unforgivable to lose to at Alabama.
Well,
and, yeah, we'll see how this goes going forward.
There's been some comparison to Nick Saban's first year. Was it Louisiana Monroe or one of those teams that they lost to? But very different when you look at the talent that was on the field for Nick Saban in year one and Kalen DeBoer in year one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, 2007, Nick Saban loses to ULM. I mean, there's conspiracy theorists that think he sort of sandbagged that game, but you know, I don't necessarily believe any of that. But you are right. I mean, it was such a different roster at the time. The recruiting had slipped a little bit. Alabama wasn't necessarily even thinking nationally recruiting at that time. Like, you have to think 2006, it was a lot different as far as, like, finding talent. Like, the internet wasn't what it is now as far as being able to just instantly see highlights from everybody on earth. So, yeah, much less talented roster compared to this season where you're supposed to have, I mean, national champion caliber roster. And you know, Vanderbilt has the guys they could convince to get to come to Vanderbilt and then could get into school. Like, it's just not a game you should be losing.
Has this had any recruiting impact? Because, I mean, that's just the negativity that has existed. Generally, teams lose games and they just kind of lose games. The national attention that this one single game has gotten, has that had any recruiting impact so far?
No, not so far. You know, I think Kalen DeBoer has, and I'll give him a ton of credit for this, like really, really kept up the recruiting. I think if you look at the 247 rankings now, they're the number two class in the country coming in this year behind Ohio State, which obviously all that's subject to change at any time. But, you know, based on the recruits I've seen, like everybody's still on board. And obviously, I mean, if this Alabama team just completely crashes out, you might see some change there. And if there's a lot of, you know, turnover on coaching staff, anything like that would cause more of a issue. But, you know, it doesn't seem like they're recruiting a lot of kids who are going to make their choices based on one game. And also, they had a lot of those kids in the building last week when they beat Georgia in the thriller. So, you know, it's they're recruiting still solid for now.
Does Alabama have real issues, or do you chalk that up as just a really weird game and a really weird weekend?
I think it's a little bit of both. The biggest issue, I mean, the defense just looked unprepared. And I think there's enough talent on that defense that I think you can kind of coast in some games. But when you're playing a team like Vanderbilt, you know, I've said this for years. I've said this in reference to Missouri before Eli Drinkwitz got things going there. Like, one of these woebegone SEC programs should start running some sort of like an option offense, mm-hmm. just to do what, you know, Georgia Southern used to do to teams, where like it's really, really hard to play the option once a year. just because, like, it's nothing that you've prepared for anywhere else all season. So it was some of that with Vanderbilt. There were some fluke elements. I mean, the winning points kind of come back to a pick six that bounced off somebody's helmet and, like, 15 feet into the air. So, you know, you get that play back, maybe we're having a different conversation. But, I mean, that defense, the defense looked unprepared, and that that can't happen going forward.
I spent 6 years covering Air Force football, and you would see very talented teams just have no clue what to do against that Air Force offense.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, I've said for years, it's Missouri, you know, one of the Mississippi schools, like Vanderbilt. Somebody should try it. It's it evens out your talent sort of in the same way that some of the air raid stuff Josh Heupel has done through the years does.
You covered Mizzou for quite some time. Just before we get you out of here, I'm sure you have thoughts on what's going on there, where their first two games against lesser opponents, they were dominant. They didn't give up a point. Then all of a sudden you start to see some blemishes, but they still got wins against Boston College and Vanderbilt, and Boston College was a top 25 team. And then they go to Texas A&M, and those blemishes that you saw in those last two games become just full-out problems, and they just get run off the field by Texas A&M. How do you feel about what's going on right now Columbia?
You know, it seemed like they lost a lot of talent on defense the offseason. You know, you lose Blake Baker. I don't think you could take that lightly either. But, you know, it just seems like they haven't quite been there with the explosive offense that you'd expect Mizzou to have, given the wide receiving core and having Brady Cook back. And, you know, they don't have Cody Schrader on that team anymore either, which, you know, I think they miss him. But, you know, beyond that, they ran into a very, very competent Texas A&M team, too, like one that was going to take advantage of every mistake. So, yeah, we'll see going forward, I think, there.
I do wonder if this schedule legitimately allows them to get into the college football playoff outside of a win against Alabama, because even if they win out the schedule outside, if they lose to Alabama, which I think they're likely to do in Tuscaloosa, there's no guarantee that Oklahoma is going to be ranked when they play them later in the season. Oklahoma has a tough schedule in front of them, and they're at number 18. Those are the two ranked teams left on the schedule. There's a scenario where Mizzou goes 10-2, and just getting run off the field by Texas A&M is such a big thing that they're on the outside looking in.
Yeah, you see it with a few of the teams this year, because Ole Miss also has a really, like, fairly, I guess, what you would call an easy schedule in the SEC, where, you know, if had they been back in the SEC West and Mizzou was back in the SEC East, there would be these, like, guaranteed, like, games against pretty tough opponents that you would have that would really boost your strength of schedule. But, I mean, you kind of saw it with Georgia last year. I think Missouri might sort of fall into the same scenario, right, where Georgia got that game against Oklahoma canceled because they were joining the SEC and they want to play it as a non-conference game. So when they lose to Alabama and that's their first loss of the year, like, the rest of their strength of schedule is so rough that they make the 14 playoff. And, you know, if Mizzou drops another one, yeah, you're right. It could sort of be that same scenario, but in the 12 team.
Is this the argument to get one more league game on the schedule in the SEC so teams have one more opportunity to have a big, big opponent?
Yeah, and it's probably more than that. I think it's more of a, like, you gotta get some of these teams' rivalries on the schedule every single year. Just, like, some way to guarantee that everybody's going to see some quality opponents through the years. And, you know, you never know. Like, I remember there were years where, like, the Pac-12 would just completely cannibalize itself with all of its good teams beating each other. And, you know, maybe that's where the SEC kind of is getting at this point, where, like, if there's not a one dominant presence in the league, maybe they run into issues with teams just kind of, like, eating each other alive here.
Yeah, but my pushback on that is that ESPN's not going to let that happen. Like, they will always, as long as this college football playoff exists and as long as you've got top teams from the SEC, they're going to do everything in their power to make sure that multiple SEC teams have a pathway in.
No, you're right, and I could yell about ESPN's influence on the sport all day, but... Yeah, no, I think that's really fair. I don't think you saw it last year. Like, I'll say it on St. Louis radio, but I don't know that I'd necessarily say it on Tuscaloosa radio. Florida State should have been in last season. Like, it's bogus that they weren't. They got sort of cheated by ESPN or whoever's making that call. So, Yeah, no, you're right. ESPN will have its SEC teams in there. It'll have its Big Ten teams in there. God forbid they start getting a bunch of auto bids, it'll get even worse.
Absolutely. Well, Matt, great to talk to you. It's awesome to see you continuing to do well covering Alabama, and hopefully we can continue to chat with you every once in a while.
Absolutely, anytime.
Awesome, very good. That's Matt Stahl, part of the team at AL.com, covers the Crimson Tide based out of Tuscaloosa. Some of the audio that resulted out of that Alabama game is just wild. We're going to play some of it for you coming up in just a moment. This is the Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauly on KMOX.
So I realize I'm doing a sports radio show in St. Louis, and I don't want to make this a show nothing but the fact that Vanderbilt beat Alabama. But I was actually explaining to my wife today, like, how notable this was and how much of a like a national sports story it was, and some of the audio that came out of it was just wild. I want to play some of it for you. This audio is courtesy of ESPN and the Paul Feinbaum show. A caller, his name's Legend, called in, did a 6-minute diatribe about Alabama losing to Vanderbilt. I'm not going to play for you, obviously, the entire 6 minutes, but I'll play 41 seconds where this is what he compares Kalen DeBoer to as a result of Alabama losing to Vanderbilt.
This is equivalent to coming home and finding your wife in bed with the neighbor. This is what this is equivalent to, Paul. And I say this for this. Me and K-Dub both agree. You could never trust her again. You might stay with her for the kids' sake, but you could never trust her. And the same thing's true with Coach DeBoer. You can win a natty. We can't trust your ass now. You just proved that you can beat the best and lose to the worst in a 2-week friggin' period. You don't lose to Vanderbilt. That's the ugliest little sister on the block. You don't lose to Vanderbilt. You just don't friggin' do it, dude.
The audio courtesy of ESPN and the Paul Feinbaum show. He did 6 minutes of that. Just classic. Lane Kiffin, the Ole Miss football coach, he's in the middle of his press conference after their game on Saturday. There's a TV in the press room. He stops his press conference and says this.
How many timeouts does Alabama have? One left.
They had all three of you.
They have one left, 118. All right. Sorry, I didn't. I mean, this is like a once-in-a-lifetime thing going on. Better watch. You're not going to see it probably ever again.
That was right in the middle of the Lane Kiffin press conference. And then it even impacts Saturday Night Live. Nate Bargatze, who's just a hilarious comedian, hosted SNL on Saturday night. When they're doing the end of it and he's doing all the thank yous, and he is from he's from Tennessee. I think he lives in Nashville. He's from Tennessee. This is what he had to say.
Captain Dana Barney.
So Vanderbilt beat Alabama, made it on to the end of SNL on Saturday night. That's just some of the amazing audio that came out as a result of Alabama losing to Vanderbilt on Saturday, which is why. By the way, I know this is a sports show. Quick sidebar on SNL. I try to watch SNL as much as possible. I am amazed by how different the show can be based off who the host is. So Nate was on last year, and it was like the one really funny episode of SNL. And then this year on the season premiere, it was terrible. I forget the name of the person who was hosting. And then Nate's on, and I'm thinking, okay, this is probably going to be funny. And it was. Those writers, I guess they write very exclusively for whoever the host is going to be. It's crazy that SNL can have such a... from 1 week to the next, can be really funny or not funny just based on who's hosting. So, yeah, it was actually funny this past. Generally, I feel like I don't get the jokes because I'm too old for it. I'm 42. I should not be too old for jokes on SNL, but I feel that way very often. This is a Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauly on KMOX.
We are back at it here on a Tuesday night, first show of the week. We had Monday Night Football last night with the Chiefs playing, so we were not on. We've got full shows this week, every night except Thursday. We'll have Thursday Night Football coming up. We're not that far out from having Billikens basketball. They're going to be getting their season here in the next month or so. So always a lot of things going on here at KMOX. Update on the baseball playoffs. It is over. Game number one of the NLDS doubleheader. The Mets beat the Phillies by a 7-2 score, and the Mets take a 2-1 series lead. Sports producer extraordinaire Kyle Sixton and I were talking about this earlier. We actually started this conversation a couple days ago, and I kind of changed my answer. He asked me what team I want to see win. And Kyle, when I first talked to you, I actually mentioned the Phillies because I'm a Bryce Harper guy. I'm a fan of Bryce Harper. I've changed kind of the team that I'm going for from a National League side of things. I enjoy the fact that every team that has ever ended the Brewers season in the playoffs has always gone on to the World Series, hasn't always won the World Series, but they have always been in the World Series, both in the American League days for the Brewers and in the National League days. Every team that has ever ended the Brewers season has gone on to the World Series, so I am now Team Mets.
That's hilarious. And the Cardinals are in there. 2011 knocked off the Brewers, went on to win it that year. So why not, right?
Yeah. So you streaks like that are cool. Like that, and it's been going on for a while. So I am I'm Team Mets on this one. They take the 2-1 series lead. Going to be tough for them to win this series against the Phillies, but they're closer now, up 2-1. Going to be even tougher, I think, for them to beat either the Padres or the Dodgers. That series 1-1. I think largely the St. Louis rooting contingent is rooting for the Padres because there's such affinity for Mike Schilt still in this town. So I know a lot of Cardinals fans. But then there's the Manny Machado thing. And he comes off so unlikable. So unlikable. And way too much was made of like the ball being thrown. If you would have heard Dave Roberts talk about it, you would have thought that like Machado threw a 90-mile-per-hour strike at his face. That didn't happen. He tossed the ball into the dugout, which is somewhat disrespectful, but Machado's always been that guy.
He has.
He makes a you-know-what out of himself. So there's high emotions going in that. I saw some of the video. We always see videos when the Dodgers and Giants play where fans are fighting outside. Like, that's a heated rivalry. The Dodgers-Padres has never been that kind of rivalry, but with everything going on the field, we're seeing that the delay the other day when the ball got thrown in from the stands. I mean, that thing has really heated up.
It has, and I mean, with Flaherty and Machado, like you said, Machado's already always kind of done stuff like that. That one sticks out to me with Donaldson all those years ago, where he kind of threw the bat at him almost. If you remember that when he was on the Orioles, there's just always been stuff like this with Machado, and it makes him. You don't really want to root for him, but at the same time, don't love the Dodgers either, so not really sure where to go on that one.
When I was covering the Brewers, when I was in Milwaukee, the Padres and Brewers were playing in the postseason. I think that was the NLCS year when the Dodgers beat the Brewers in seven games to get to the World Series. And Jesus Aguilar was the first baseman for Milwaukee, and Machado's just running out a ground ball, and he just spikes the living you-know-what out of Aguilar's ankle. So Aguilar's just on there on the base, ready to take, you know, it's a ground ball out, and Machado just stabs his foot into the ankle of Aguilar. Like, that's the crap that he does, and he gets somewhat of a free pass, I think, for it. At some point, something has to happen to the guy.
Yeah, and I mean, for that reason, you don't really see us rooting for him for that reason. It's just pretty unlikable, so.
The American League, the first time ever that going into today, going into game three of all the four series, first time in the history of the divisional series where all four series were tied 1-1. Today was an off day for the American League. Tomorrow is another amazing day of baseball because it's going to be four games starting. The first game's going to start at 2 o'clock. The last game's going to start at 8 o'clock. So just live for those kind of days of baseball. These American League series are interesting as well. Tigers with that Carey Carpenter home run the other day to even up the series against the Guardians. That was a fantastic moment. I've got an affinity for the Royals because I spent time previously working in their organization when I was broadcasting minor league baseball. Glad that they were able to go back to Kansas City with that series at 1-1. I also think that I think there's something to learn from Kansas City. And we've talked about this a fair amount because the Royals had an offseason that when it was happening, we kept calling it like a sneaky good offseason. When they're bringing in like Michael Wacha and Seth Lugo and guys like that, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful to either of those guys. They clearly have had a huge impact on that team. But generally speaking, we can go back. Like if you do a Twitter search for the month of February, year by year, and you find the use of the term sneaky good offseason, most of those teams that you're talking about, it wasn't actually a good offseason. Like there was a couple nice players that you're bringing in the organization, but it wasn't really impactful change. So if you compare the sneaky good offseason that you thought a team had going into spring training and what the results are when you get into September, more often than not, those teams that have sneaky good offseasons, it actually wasn't that good of an offseason. There's a reason we put sneaky on it, because you can tell what's a legit good offseason and what's not. The Royals have been a little bit of the exception there. And I keep talking about this, and I'm not trying to begrudge a point. I'm really, really not. But what we can look at with the Royals, and this is why I think there's something to learn from them. Not only did they go get the Seth Lugos and the Michael Wachas, but if we're being really honest, is there really that much of a difference? And Lugo had a fantastic like first half of the season, and his numbers were really good, and he was in Cy Young Award contention for much of the year. Like I realize all of that, and I'm not trying to rewrite history. But if we really take a step back, is there really that much difference between Seth Lugo and Michael Wacha and Lance Lynn and Kyle Gibson? I would take Lugo and Wacha over Gibson and Lynn. I would, but it's not like this just gigantic difference. And Kansas City had the sneaky good offseason, and the Cardinals, those two guys did not get referred to in that kind of way. Obviously, people were happy about the Sonny Gray signing, but more so than anything else, it was as the Royals have kind of gone into a new era of what they're at right now, is their ability to build behind the scenes with adding the infrastructure that they need to add, adding to the analytics departments, things like that. They have given that organization the tools to allow players to best perform. And I think that's going to be a pretty good team here for a while. I'm not trying to like go all Kansas City here. We always take grief from folks because there's a contingent of people who do not like the Kansas City Chiefs because they think the Kansas City Chiefs are partially responsible for the Rams leaving St. Louis. And like the explanation for that, the reason people believe that, they voted. They were part of the voting group that allowed the Rams to leave St. Louis. So that is a valid point. I would never, ever, ever, ever be dismissive of people who feel that way. I think it's a very valid way to feel. Obviously, the Chiefs have become incredibly popular here in St. Louis, and we know that running the games on the weekend, running the game last night, there's tons of people who enjoy it. Now, the people who don't enjoy it, the people who are very anti-Kansas City and the people who are very anti-Chiefs, they are also very vocal about that. So we hear it fairly often. But that's again, don't want to spend too much time on Kansas City stuff, but I think there is something to learn from the Royals and the kind of turnaround they had from last season to this season. And then obviously the national sports story that has become the Kansas City Chiefs having a really, really good performance last night. So with all that being said, Jay Binkley works for our sister station in Kansas City. We've had him on a couple times. Wanted to talk both Royals and Chiefs with him. He's going to join us coming up in just a moment. This is a Gray Bar Sports Open Line on KMOX. It's Gray Bar Sports Open Line here on KMOX as we continue on throughout the program. Of course, we are your home for Kansas City Chiefs football here in St. Louis. And yesterday, Chiefs looked pretty darn good. There's a lot going on in Kansas City. The Royals are in the playoffs, and we're very happy to be able to bring on to the program from our sister station in Kansas City. We used to say 610 Sports. Now we say 96.5 The Fan. He is Jay Binkley. You follow him on Twitter at 3GuysInAGarage. Jay, appreciate you taking some time with us today. How are you?
Oh, doing great, man. Doing great. Salvador Perez, I'm not out there right now, but they obviously earlier today I was watching at the press conference, you know, seeing him talking about it, just like 14 and 15. It brings back these, you know, playoff memories. You know, it's so much fun And Kansas City will have so much fun when the fans finally are booing the other team and not the Royals, as Salvador Perez said.
Jay, you know what's fun for me in this? I spent 2 years as the broadcaster for the Kansas City Royals Low A affiliate in Burlington, Iowa. And my two years there, we got to the championship of the Midwest League each year, won it once. I had Salvi, I had Moustakas, I had Perez, I had Danny Duff, I had all those guys who were on those World Series teams. As you know, most of those guys are long gone. I saw Moustakas was throwing out first pitch at a Brewers game the other day. But, man, Salvi's still going strong, and it's been so long since I broadcast minor league baseball. I so appreciate continuing to see one of my former guys out there.
You know, he's the only one going, and that whole core group – with Hosmer, Moustakas, and Perez, and when Lorenzo came and they traded up for him and he was in the minor league, they wanted every step. They wanted A ball. They wanted double A championship. They wanted triple A championship. And a lot of the things are going on now in the minor leagues, but the one thing that kind of makes Salvador Perez unique was, you know, he was part of that group, the young group that came up, like Hosmer and Moose, and being World Series MVP, then all the bad years for the Royals, losing 106 games last year. And then being with this young core like Bobby Witt Jr. and Vinny Pasquantino, and he's still there. Like the only player from those teams even still playing, which is crazy.
Yeah, it is. But it's fun for me. He can play as long as he wants, as far as I'm concerned. What was the level of dread when Royals fans realized that they were going to see the Yankees in the playoffs?
You know, I was excited about it. I think there's kind of a split in fans, younger fans. They may not like the Yankees because it's the big market Yankees or whatever, but then the older fans, you know, like myself, you know, remember the times. 1980, I was 7 years old when I went out there, but I did end up going to that series, and then the series one game against the Phillies. But, you know, meeting the Yankees in 76, 77, 78, and 80 just showed, I mean, this was the big rivalry for the Royals in that time period. Now, of course, it's a split now. Between the teams, and they haven't seen each other since that 1980 World Series, at least in the postseason. So, to me, it's fun. It's always those hated Yankees. I know there's a lot of people confused about the playoffs because the Tigers were the sixth seed, the Royals were the five. They say, well, why aren't the Royals playing, or why aren't the Yankees playing the Tigers? Because normal bracketing is six would play the one. But Major League Baseball doesn't want a one seed like the Yankees having to play division winner had the Astros won. So, Right. Weird deal.
Yeah.
Weird deal.
Yeah,
they're excited about it.
It's a good win yesterday too. I mean, that was a highly contested game. Even when the Royals are up by three runs through the final few innings, it felt like every pitch, every swing matters. I know we say that about every playoff game, but that was a big win for the Royals to be able to bring it back home, even 1-1.
I mean, that was crucial, and to kind of block out of the mind what happened in the first game. You know, the play at second base, which ended up being, when Jazz Chisholm, you know, was out at second base, the replay showed him out. But the Yankees, they looked at the replay and said he was safe. That did make a huge difference in that game. Of course, the Royals didn't need to walk eight guys either. But they lost that game, and they were able to take that out of their mind and say, okay, new game, fresh start the next day. And it's a very solid team. I mean, you look at the numbers on this team compared to 2014. That 2014 team went all the way to game seven of the World Series. They swept their way all the way to the World Series. Leading RBI guy in that team was 74 with Alex Gordon. 19 home runs led that team. And two guys with over 30 stolen bases. Now this year, three guys over 30 stolen bases. You've got three guys that would have hit 100 RBI. Sal Perez did, Bobby Witt did. Vinny Pasquantino got hurt right before he could. He ended up with 97 as they were the only team in Major League Baseball. They have three guys over 70 ribs, three over 80, three over 90, then they would have had three over 100. This is just a really solid team that they've built with a lot of veteran presence, like a Tommy Pham or a Michael Wacha, you know, guys coming in this team to mix with some of the young up-and-coming guys. But it's an interesting mix of what they've been able to do is veteran and young players.
Pretty remarkable that they've been able to win the wild card series and to come back home after splitting in New York with Bobby Witt Jr. hitting just 158, only three hits through four games. If you're going to win that many games, I think most people would think that Witt's going to be right in the middle of it.
Yeah, they were. And when you think about, you know, early on, that first game, the struggles between not only Perez, But Witt Jr. and Vinny Pasquantino, the guys at the bottom of the order, the ones scoring, and they were scoring more. The Baltimore series, they scored one in one game, scored two in another, and won those games. But the core wasn't hitting. The bottom of the lineup was making the crucial hits for the Royals, a lot of singles. Then, of course, this last game, Sal Perez, you know, being the captain he is, hits the home run there in Yankee Stadium. But with Witt and Pasquantino not playing like they did throughout the year, it was Bobby Witt Jr. gets on base, then he steals, then Vinny knocks it in. It was that simple. And the good news is they've been able to win and score runs without those guys. Now, if they can get some contribution from those guys, which I'm sure they will, they'll be fine.
One of the odd things about the way the playoffs are now set up with teams playing in the wild card round is it's not one versus one in terms of pitching, and that can be bad, but it can also be good if you can split those first two games. All of a sudden, the Royals are able to come back with Lugo in game three at home. They're in a pretty good spot there.
Yeah, you're talking about a guy that put up numbers, you know, was getting Cy Young consideration this year and went to the All-Star game. And yeah, I mean, that combination of going, clearly they wanted to have Reagans go longer yesterday. But the Royals, they don't fear these pitchers. I mean, yesterday Carlos Rodon was celebrating and, you know, having fun on the mound that first inning. And all of a sudden the Royals just got all over him. I mean, they lock in or not, they took care of it. They were getting good hits off of Gerrit Cole. And that Yankee starting pitching didn't scare him at all.
So I went to school at K-State, so I've got tons of friends who live in Kansas City, and I can't it feels like those World Series years again. I'm seeing friends on my Facebook putting out posts. I'm going to the game. I'm parking in this section. Come on out. And so, like, the energy that exists that I'm just kind of seeing from a social media standpoint, it really, from afar, it really seems like it's just like it was in those two World Series years. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yeah, you are. In the 70s and 80s, this was a baseball town. The 90s is when this kind of transitioned into a football town. And then in 13, when they went all the way and were eliminated the final weekend, and then 14 and 15 when they go to the postseason, became a Royals town for those periods, then back to a Chiefs town. Last night, people were just excited. Mm-hmm. They were figuring out how to watch both games. They're going to Arrowhead. They're going to watch it on their phone, the Royals. A lot of people went to the Chiefs game in Royals gear. People at home were sitting there getting two TVs. You know, I had callers call in and say they went out and got another TV so they could watch Royals and the Chiefs on one. Very excited. I think it was much easier for a lot of people to watch some of the games back in 14 and 15 with the television package now. But if you want to watch them, you can buy it. It's very easy to do. But I think people are getting accustomed now to being good in both sports. It's something that hadn't happened here. The Chiefs started off 1-5 that year. The Royals won the World Series in 15, but they ended up coming back and making the playoffs, believe it or not. But not used to both teams being really good at one time. And, you know, New York, all the talk is, you know, New York, you're playing the Royals, you're the mighty Yankees and all that. Well, every NHL team in New York, every NFL team, every Major League Baseball team, every NBA team in the last decade has zero titles. Kansas City has four between football and baseball. And the lack of respect for kind of, you know, the smaller Midwest towns compared to New York. It's funny, really, when you sit back and think about it.
We're talking with Jay Binkley, part of the team at our sister station, 96.5 The Fan in Kansas City. Let's jump over to the Chiefs because they won their first four games, but you were able to find flaws in those games. Rashee Rice goes down. You're thinking, what is this team going to look like against a pretty good Saints team? And you can make the argument that was their best performance of the year last night. What did you think of what you saw from the Chiefs?
Yeah, it was their best performance, and it should have been a lot worse. I mean, just making the little mistakes that they do. I mean, they could be putting away a lot of these teams, but the red zone struggles or the turnovers, and, you know, we're seeing a lot of the same thing. Poor Patrick Mahomes will throw the football to somebody. Like Juju Smith-Schuster had a great game yesterday, no one taking away 130 yards receiving. But the key one was the one that he dropped, bounced off his hands in the end zone that became an interception for the Saints. Then the Saints went down and scored. That was a 13-point swing just in that game, even though the Chiefs were dominating that game. The defense has been lights out and fantastic. The Chiefs have limited every good running back, the number one running backs, in the number one DVOA schedule they've played to this point. They could have been winning more. The thing is, when they put everything together, what will it be? Yesterday was Andy Reid It was his best coaching performance of the year because you're right. You're without Rashee Rice. Hollywood Brown hasn't played a snap for you this year. That was going to be the big change. Chiefs are going to have that speed on the outside with Worthy on one side, Hollywood Brown on the other, Rashee Rice there working the middle of the field. But all that goes down the wayside, you know, when they get hurt or Isaiah Pacheco gets hurt and you bring in, you know, a Kareem Hunt. I mean, you're talking two guys that were on their couch last month in Juju Smith-Schuster and Kareem Hunt, and they're out there winning in the NFL, getting 130 yards for Juju, over 100 for Kareem Hunt. It was impressive. And Andy Reid was running a lot of 14 personnel with the four tight ends. A lot of teams don't even keep four tight ends. Mm-hmm. Well, the Chiefs needed people to catch the football, and so they went in with a group of receivers to have Worthy and Justin Watson, who had 29 snaps, not even a target in that game, finding ways to win. Hey, I'm ready for when guys are healthy and Patrick Mahomes gets the weapons that he needs. I mean, you think about it. You put gas in the car, and I can't wait to see that. Because you go back and even look at a Peyton Manning. I mean, he had Reggie Wayne and Marvin Harrison to throw to. You know, those guys aren't walking through the door here at Arrowhead.
Do they make a move at some point to add to that receiver group, or is it just about waiting for getting some guys healthy and getting the most out of the guys they currently have the way they did last night?
You know, personally, I think if they do, it would be like an Amari Cooper type move that's owed $600,000 still, because the Chiefs are, what, 4.5 to 4.7 under the cap. Not much. They don't have much money to spend. Like, they don't have that big money to bring in a lot of receivers. And one thing they've been able to do is win with less, and they have to keep doing it. They rely on their quarterback, you know, that offense to get the job done. And then, of course, this defense, the way they're playing, well, they need that. If they have more of a reliance on the running game now and playing good defense, the splashy receiver, I think they'll make a move. I definitely think they're going to make a move. But this offense is so complex. So to think someone could come right in here and do it, it's more difficult than it seems. It's like last year when they made that move for Hardman because he knew the offense already. He'd already won with the Chiefs. They bring back Juju because Juju knew the offense and won a ring with the Chiefs. So, yes, I think they make a move, but it's very difficult just to be thrown right in the situation and have that chemistry with Patrick Mahomes.
Jay Binkley, part of the team at 96.5 The Fan in Kansas City, our sister station, hosting Chiefs post game and doing much, much more. Jay, enjoy this great time of Kansas City sports, and hopefully we can catch up again real soon.
Yeah, having a lot of fun, my friend. Just give me a call anytime you want to.
Jay Binkley joining us here on the program. We appreciate him spending a few moments with us talking through the cool things going on with the Royals and obviously the Chiefs as well. Speaking of cool things, the Blues get a win today. We'll hear a little from head coach Drew Bannister after they get a come-from-behind victory in Seattle. That's up next. This is a Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. Back at it on a Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauly. So the Blues win earlier today. They open up their season with a victory. You know, we don't talk about hockey, obviously, in halves because it's periods, but it really was a game of two halves. When you look at the first period and the first half of the second period, the Blues were one team. They were down 2-0. They were getting outshot. They were not playing strong defense. They weren't doing any of these things. And then all of a sudden things turned and they end up scoring three goals in a very short amount of time, and they end up winning by a 3-2 score. Wanted to play for you some of the reaction from Blues head coach Drew Bannister. And the first thing he really talked about was how everything did just flip. I mean, they were they gave up 11 shots in the first period. Early on in the second period, the shot differential was even more pronounced on the side of Seattle. And then they just were able to turn it on. And Bannister, when speaking to the media, did go through some of the things that happened that led to the turnaround.
The first, you know, half of the game, we seemed hesitant. We weren't playing on our toes. There wasn't a lot of communication on the ice between line mates, between D partners. We just seemed to be chasing the game a little bit too much. But, you know, to be honest with you, just the life on the bench was continued to be there, and just like guys pushing each other to get things going. And, you know, overturn goal, a little bit of a scrum, you know, we get to a power play, you know, we score right away off it. And then the next shift after that, it was like just a switch turn for us. We started forward checking. We were aggressive. Our D were down on pucks. Our forwards were reloading and backing up. And just seemed, you know, from the second half on, we kind of took over, you know, took control of the game.
Yeah, so he talks about it in terms of halves as well. And the way this thing went down, again, they're down 2-0, and they scored the three goals in about 3 minutes. And Jordan Kyrou ended up scoring two of those goals. Now, he mentioned the scrum. There was a disallowed goal, and then the two teams got after each other a little bit after that. And Bannister talked about maybe the energy that was brought as a result of that scrum.
I think sometimes, like, a little bit of pushback is good. And I think at that point, we needed a little bit more energy to our game. And, you know, Wox, Torpo, Fax, like, those guys, you know, there's a lot of guys that brought a lot of energy to the game once we started really getting going. But, you know, for whatever reason, it kind of jump-started us a little bit. But certainly the power play goal really brought life to our bench.
I said this earlier, and I'm going to repeat it, and you're going to hear me repeat it over and over and over and over again. I think there's two really big keys for the Blues this year if they want to have a level of success where they are a legitimate playoff contender. I think Jordan Kyrou has to be close to a 40-goal scorer, and I think defensively they need to be they have to play above their heads defensively. When you look at who they have on the roster, they have to play better defensively than what you would think that they would be. So they've got to outperform a little bit from a defensive standpoint. If they do those, if those two things happen, I think the people who are excited and high on this Blues team, those are that's kind of the equation that leads to them being better than maybe they look like they should be on paper. So Jordan Kyrou scores the two goals. One's a power play goal. The other goal is the one that gives the team the 3-2 lead. That ends up being the final score. So last year, Kyrou leads the team 31 goals. But it was kind of a slow start for him. He did get his first goal in the second game, but then it took another 8 games for him to get his second. So he is where he's at right now with 2 goals is essentially where he was at 10 games into the season last year. And Bannister did talk about Kyrou and what he saw from him today.
You know, took advantage of his opportunities. There was a couple of more opportunities where I'd like to see him, you know, really bear down. But he's finding areas. Guys were finding him. Again, he's using his speed. He's competing. And, you know, good things happen when he's doing that.
Look, we're going to be doing a lot of comparing from last year to this year, and certainly one of the things that let the Blues down at time was their ability to score with the man advantage. Well, they score a power play goal today. That was good. Their first goal does come on the power play, and Bannister talked a little bit about the importance of not just scoring power play goals, but scoring them early on in the season and trying to gain some traction with the man advantage.
I think just early in the year, just for confidence, like I think it goes a long way with our group. You know, I like the way they moved the puck. I thought there were some chances even on their second time when we came out in the third period where, you know, they had some pretty good looks and we just missed. But, you know, I still believe, like, our group was going to keep pushing. Like, at some point it was going to turn for us, you know, whether it was power play or walks. I just felt, you know, at that time, you could feel the confidence on our bench. Like, we were ready to kind of turn the page and get back to work.
You know, earlier I talked about my keys for the season being defense and Jordan Kyrou. I didn't mention Jordan Binnington because I'm at a point right now with Binnington where I just think he's just a legit really good goalie and you can count on him. Like, I count on that from Binnington. I think he's going to be able to, he's going to keep you in games, and he's certainly going to go out and win you some games. So obviously good goaltending is a key to the equation for the Blues having success as well. So Binnington, with the Blues just completely being outshot in the first period, the Blues and Seattle were able to skate to a 0-0 tie after one period. Now, Binnington does give up the two early goals early on the second period, but I mean, he was just being peppered shot after shot after shot. It wasn't fair. And then all of a sudden, the Blues take that lead and he really locked in after that. So he faces 32 shots. He makes 30 saves. You'll take that. That was a good day for Binnington, and his coach obviously was pleased with the performance.
It's like you can have a long conversation and not bring up his name, but he's the reason.
Yeah, Benner was outstanding early on when we weren't at our best, you know, and we saw that a lot last year, and we had to rely on him early to keep that game close, and I thought he did that well for us. You know, and again, then the guys rallied for him, and we found a way to win a hockey game for him.
And then the final thing from Bannister speaking just a few moments ago in Seattle. Defensively, things changed. The Blues were not good defensively, again, for that first half of the game, for the first period and the first half of the second period, and then things flipped. And maybe they flipped because they felt the energy from the goal scoring, but they were really good defensively, especially in the third period as well. The Blues on the road in a pretty good environment there in Seattle, opening up the season, they played an entire third period with a one-goal lead, and they were able to protect that lead without adding on, and they get the 3-2 victory. And even though it was a rough start defensively for the Blues, Bannister was obviously very happy with what he saw, especially in the third period from his defensive groups.
I think just the whole third period, we were really good. You know, I mean, the shots that they got were probably in the power play, but, you know, after that, there was limited chances. You know, I thought we supported the puck well. We were, you know, pretty good on the walls. Our D got back to pucks, but we forced them to play from their goal line back. You know, we were able to get in a forecheck, and we created some good offensive opportunities where their goalie had to make some pretty difficult saves.
So that's Drew Bannister speaking after the Blues getting the win in Seattle. Again, that's a... that's a good victory. That's a really good victory for this team. And good to see them pick up the win. And hopefully they're able to take some momentum throughout the rest of this trip. Tough start to the season. Really tough start to the season for them as they play three straight games on the road out west. They will travel. They're probably traveling right now to San Jose. They'll spend the day there tomorrow, play their Thursday night. And then they're doing the back-to-back. They're playing the three games in 4 days, West Coast, after they play in San Jose on Thursday night. They'll make the quick trip over to Vegas, and they'll match up against the Golden Knights on Friday night. They'll get back into St. Louis late Friday, and then they'll have the weekend until they open up the home portion of their schedule. And they're going to play four straight home games. They'll welcome in Minnesota on Tuesday. Then they'll play the Islanders, Carolina, and Winnipeg all on this homestand. I was listening to somebody talk about this recently. I think it was somebody that was on the Dave Glover show. They were talking about people visiting St. Louis. And I think the conversation was based around the impact of the Cardinals. Because if you live in Arkansas, or if you live in Tennessee, or if you live in Oklahoma, you can come into St. Louis for a weekend, or you can come into St. Louis for a week. You can catch multiple Cardinals games in addition to doing other things. And the point that was made was the Blues schedule largely kind of presents in the same way. There's a lot of extended homestands. So they'll play, the four straight home games coming up. They've got another stretch from November 2nd to November 12th where they're going to play five straight home games. They'll have another stretch coming up later. So there's a handful of times in January. They'll play four straight home games from January 9th to January 16th. Not to make this, and I mean, I could go through the entire schedule. There's many more situations like that as the year goes along. But as somebody that wants people to visit St. Louis and have a reason to come in, and just sports very much being the front door to our city sometimes, if the schedule can work out where the Blues can have multiple home games in a week or so, and folks can come in and enjoy a game or two and also do a few other things, I think I prefer that style of scheduling. You don't always get that in the NHL, but 3-4, sometimes 5-game homestands, even if it results in going on the road for 3-4-5 games at a time, I think there is some value to extended homestands. Now, on the other side of it, you're on the road for a long time. That wears on you, especially these, like this West Coast trip, maybe not because it's the first trip of the year. But when you're playing three games in 4 days, so you've got a back-to-back in there and they're on the road, that's always a pretty solid challenge. All right, one more break. We'll come back and we will wrap up this edition of the program. It's a Graybar Sports Open Line, and we're back with more on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on King of OX.
Just a couple minutes left in the program. At your service with Dave Simons on the way after the 8 o'clock news. You certainly won't want to miss that. This just came down over the last hour or so. I'm going to try to spend some more time on this tomorrow. Those of you who listen to me on an everyday basis, you know that when it comes to college athletics and the changing dynamic of all things in college athletics is something I enjoy talking about, I'm passionate about. The NCAA Division I Council announcing today that they have voted to shorten the transfer portal window for FBS football, FCS football, men's and women's basketball. So the total number of days that players in FBS and FCS football can enter the transfer portal will go from 45 days to 30 days. But they have preserved the spring transfer window. There was some talk about closing the spring transfer window. They are going to move forward with a 20-day window from December 9th, the Monday after the conference championship game, through December 28th, and then a 10-day spring window. That's going to take place in April. The basketball thing is what I'm more concerned about. And honestly, it's because of things like teams opting out of the NIT because players are going to be transferring out, or because coaches feel like they got to go work the transfer portal and they don't have time to coach their team in the NIT. It's ridiculous. It's wrong. It's some of the worst aspects of college athletics. I know these kids are getting paid money now with NIL. I'm not trying to be, I don't know, have a utopian thought on this. I get it. Like it is a business, but it is still college athletics. It is still 18 to 22-year-olds maybe playing the final college athletics games of their lives, and they're not going to get a chance to play in the NIT because their coach wants to go work the transfer portal? Like, I hate that. I can't tell you how much I hate that. So they've pushed back the opening of the transfer portal in basketball until after the end of the second round of the NCAA tournament. I'm not sure if that's going to fix this problem with teams opting out of the NIT and things like that, but it won't hurt. And maybe it's a good step forward. Again, we're going to talk about this a fair amount tomorrow because I've got thoughts, and I think it's very, very, very important when it comes to college athletics. Certainly appreciate you being tuned into the program today. Thanks to all of my guests as well. Dave Simons up next with At Your Service. I'm back with you tomorrow at 6 o'clock here on KMOX.